Blog Talk Radio.
923, I'll give you a corrected address, but you have a fire in a one story. Ordinary, looks like it's about 40 by 120, 125. Get your traffic control. Squad 5. Over to 273, 273.
Hi, this is Dr. Beth Murphy, and I'm on tonight, well, tonight for me, talking about firefighter behavioral health. So, quick background, I'm a retired firefighter and a clinical psychologist in private practice, and somebody who's very passionate about the overall health and wellness of firefighters. My goal is to help educate everyone to take care of themselves, take care of others. So, the saying that firefighters always say is that I've got your back. That's essentially what I'm hoping everybody will do for each other. And then also have the administration and the chief and all the other agencies, organizations that support the fire department learn a few things so that they all can contribute to the overall health and wellness of firefighters so they may come in healthy and go out healthy. I would like to see generation after generation of firefighters be able to retire and have a full life after retirement. And I think that it's been a struggle in the past, but I think we're moving that direction. So I would like to thank Blog Talk Fire Engineering and Penwell for the opportunity to present for Fire Engineering on Blog Talk Radio. So anybody who would like to call in as a guest tonight, the number is 760-454-8852. I usually forget to put that out there, usually because I think about how most people listen to this recorded and not live. If you are listening to this recorded, obviously you can't call in, but you can still contact me. I like to offer myself as a resource to help direct people, answer questions for whatever comes up. And also if you have suggestions for what I should talk about next. So my number that you could reach me at is 425-281-7977. And that's my office number. And then my email is blmurphy63@mac.com. So you're welcome to email me with any questions. So if you've listened to my show in the past, then you know that I sometimes arrive at my topics through my own personal experiences, but also from questions that I might get. Sometimes they're questions I get in the classes I teach. Sometimes it's questions that come up in the course of discussions that I have. It seems like I have many, many interesting discussions when I go to various conferences. And I think sometimes the information that comes out of those discussions is a lot better sometimes than what comes out of my classes. So I think it's just a different setting and I'm less nervous. So I'm sure that you all have experienced when you're nervous, sometimes you forget what you want to say. So I'm human and it happens to me too. So I found myself for tonight's topic thinking about what I talked about last time and how that ties in with like resiliency. And then resiliency made me think about compassion fatigue. So I thought tonight I would try to address both resiliency and compassion fatigue. I think they kind of go hand in hand. So I may end up focusing more on one than the other. I'd like to kind of tie it in also to some of the clients that I've been seeing recently and obviously some of the discussions and also my own experience with it. So last week I talked about invisible disabilities. And so there are a multitude of invisible disabilities. I mean, obviously those are things that we don't see that people struggle with, that sometimes like the normal, and I said normal in air quotes, everyday world can be challenging for people with a disability. So obviously, you know, we see people who, if they're in a wheelchair or on crutches, having to navigate like stairs. Now I've gone upstairs with crutches, and it's really difficult and actually a little bit dangerous. But if you're in a wheelchair, then you don't have any capacity to go up the stairs. So we're very used to seeing that type of disability, and then we see the accommodations for that. We can see how people are impacted and how making appropriate accommodations allow them to function in the world a lot better. So with invisible disabilities, it's something that we don't see. It's more difficult to accommodate. You wouldn't even think about having to have accommodations because you don't see it. So people need to recognize it and then make their employer, make it known to their employer. Now, one of the, obviously, since I'm a psychologist, I focus on mental health. So mental health disorders like depression, anxiety, PTSD, and then I talked a bit about also like ADHD and dyslexia. There's other types of learning disorders. We know dyslexia more than others, but there are other ways that it manifests. But those are things that we don't see that can make living and functioning in everyday life and living in the world and being productive, it can make it really difficult. And when we're talking about mental health-related stuff like anxiety, depression, and PTSD, for instance, those are things that when we see it in the fire service, it's generally something that has developed because of everyday stressors and stress of the job and stress in dealing with the fire service, the administration. I mean, everything that goes into it. I mean, we can't escape stress. Stress is part of our life. So when you go into the fire service, you're healthy. I mean, you're considered healthy. You're perceived as healthy. And if your department does psychological testing, then you get the blessing of the psychologist that you're healthy. Some of the things like ADHD and dyslexia, those are things that may make it more difficult to test, to do your recruit book if you have your recruits do that, or to learn new information. It doesn't prevent it, but it can make it harder. And most people, by the time they reach the age where they're testing in the fire service, they've already found a lot of ways that they can accommodate themselves. So they've already developed their strategies. But that also can play into some of the stress they may experience. And those things can contribute to like feeling bad about yourself and not feeling smart enough or quick enough or whatever. So that's a stress on top of everything else that can develop. So as we talk about stress, then that kind of leads us towards this idea of compassion fatigue. Now, I don't know how many of you have ever thought about compassion fatigue or really know what it is. It is, so this is why I'm here, I'm going to tell you. So when you're overwhelmed by stress, that stress affects us cognitively, physically, and emotionally. And if we don't do anything about it, then we can develop the mental health disorders or symptoms of mental health disorders. So maybe we don't develop a full-blown depression, for instance, but we could. Because basically we've overloaded our system and all the cascading effects of the stress reaction, stress response, it all adds up and it takes a toll. And so we have to be able to recognize when that's going on. And I think that the idea of compassion fatigue, I think that if we start thinking about that a little bit and how we can counter that, which moves us towards, that would move us towards the idea of resiliency or resiliency training, that may help us. I mean, it may help everybody in the fire service and prevent more people from developing a mental health disorder and the worst case scenario of considering suicide as an option to deal with that. So with compassion fatigue, we have overall, it's a negative aspect of working as a helper. So that's what you are. As firefighters, you are the ultimate helper. Now, I remember when I got hired, I was so excited. Like, I thought I had won the lottery. I mean, one, because it was a huge pay increase for me. Two is I actually thought it was going to get me out of customer service. I used to work retail, like grocery and, stores, clothing stores, so retail. So I dealt with customers all the time, and I really didn't like it. I like people. I did not like retail. So I thought the fire service was going to be the opposite of that. And boy, was I in for a surprise, because it is the ultimate customer service job. So you help people. And you help them in their worst time, and you help them because something went wrong. And they may have done it, or somebody else may have done it, or it was something completely out of their control. And then you deal with them and their emotionality, and you're looked at as the person that is supposed to solve the problem. So compassion fatigue, that's that negative aspect of working as a helper. Now, the alternative or the flip side of that is compassion satisfaction. And compassion satisfaction is the positive aspects of working as a helper. Now, I'm sure, and I know this from my own experience and in talking about it with friends that I know are, that are still in the fire service, and talking with my clients that are firefighters, everybody went in with this positive idea of what the fire service would be. And through a lot of stressors, experiencing a lot of stressors, both on and off the job, they may come see me because they're overwhelmed and they're having a hard time identifying or seeing those positive aspects. And so they're very much in the realm of that compassion fatigue. Now, the compassion fatigue is divided out into two sub-conditions. So burnout, which is inefficiency and feeling overwhelmed, and then work-related traumatic stress. And so there's a primary traumatic stress where you experience the trauma yourself, and then the secondary traumatic exposure where it, basically you witness it. So you're not the primary person, but you have some relationship with that person via either they're a coworker or maybe they're somebody, a friend or a loved one that you happen to respond to, because I've had that happen, or you're engaged with the victim. So it's like the person who called you or who you were called on their behalf. So, and in responding to them and helping them, then you're engaged in a relationship with them. So these things affect everybody. And in the fire service for so long, you know, firefighters were thought to be invincible. And I've heard numerous times from firefighters that I've talked with or who I've worked with, and even me, I have thought this, is that we are there to help. We are the helpers. We don't ask for help. and I think that that's been kind of the view of us in the public eye, too. So, you know, it's like it's almost like we're invincible. So, and since I'm bringing my experience in here too, it's like I'm saying we. So I'm not a firefighter now, but I still very much identify with it. So we're kind of set up to, almost set up to fail in a way, because eventually stuff piles up, it accumulates. There's an intersection between work stressors and life stressors, so home life, whatever your home life is like, and it starts to overwhelm our ability to handle it. So we start to feel a little bit burned out. And even though they have, in this model that I'm looking at, you've got compassion fatigue listed. It's one block, and then under it, you've got burnout and then the work-related traumatic stress. Now, I feel like the way I look at it and the way I interpret the information is that I look at burnout as being something that you experience and can actually recognize maybe a little sooner than perhaps the traumatic stress part. But it's possibly with some training, you would recognize both. And the idea is that if you can recognize where these things might come into play for you, like when would it overwhelm you? So basically it's identifying your weaknesses. Then you can train, you can make yourself stronger. So recognizing when you're starting to feel burned out, when you're starting to experience that traumatic stress. And sometimes we have warning for the traumatic stress and sometimes we don't. So it would be normal to have a reaction to a traumatic stress. And then as that reaction lingers, then we start getting into that realm of there's something, there might be something wrong, and it would be helpful to have assistance in managing that. So when the stress reactions linger, then that's a sign that your ability to cope is being overwhelmed. So I know, like with burnout, I recognize burnout, and I've heard this type of talk from a lot of people, is like when you feel like you need a vacation, or when you wake up and you say to yourself, I really don't want to go to work. Those are some signs. Those are like probably some of the early signs that you're feeling burned out. A later sign can be like feeling hopeless about your job, feeling inefficient, ineffective. So people, I've heard this a lot from people in neighboring departments where they deal with a lot of calls where people are overdosing. So we've all heard of the opioid crisis, and that's creating a lot of burnout in a lot of places. The name of the movie eludes me at the moment, but Chief Jan Rader was just back. Well, she went to the Oscars, and she was actually just featured in my Time's Top 100 Most Interesting or Influential People. And she is in Huntington Beach, West Virginia. And she talked, I mean, years ago about how burned out people were getting, how burned out her people were getting, because they were going on multiple overdose calls for the same person over the course of the 24-hour shift. And I'm hearing, and so there is a movie about it, and it was nominated for an award. I honestly don't know if it got the award, but it's been something that's been talked about. So look it up, Google it, see if you can find it. So I plan on watching it. But I'm hearing more and more from surrounding departments, particularly in areas where there's less affluence, of these repeated overdoses. And the firefighters are tired of going on these repeated calls, and they're not feeling like they're making a difference. So they're starting to experience that hopelessness about the situation, because all they can do is go and administer the Narcan, and the hospitals don't want to see them, and the cops don't want to do anything with them. So it just leaves the firefighters and the paramedics responding repeatedly to the same person who has this addiction to an opioid, and they're constantly overdosing. And so they start feeling hopeless. They start feeling like they don't make a difference. Like no matter what they do, they're not making anything better. And then depending on how the administration deals with all this and everybody else that supports this process, that feeling can get a lot worse. So, and that's not necessarily the thing that is creating this overall burnout, but it's like one thing, and it's one thing that then you can have another thing pile on it. So finding ways to counteract that hopelessness. I mean, obviously, as a firefighter, you can't stop that person from injecting. And there have been so many solutions floated out there that, you don't know what's going to work. And there's a lot of resistance to some of the things that have been proposed and have shown improvement in other countries. So, So it's not an easy solution, and it really is above you as a firefighter and even you as an officer or you as a chief. I mean, you're part of the overall solution, but you're not going to be able to solve it by yourself. So that can, that's one thing. And then, so the next thing is, well, how does administration support you? How do they help you deal with this one aspect? And then what other aspects are there in the job? You know, like what other, like frequent flyers? You know, if you're going and seeing the same people over and over again for different reasons, or going to a fire and not having adequate equipment. I mean, there's a lot of things that can contribute to why you might feel like you're not as effective. So, so these are things, it's important to recognize that this is going on. And then you have to spend some mental energy in trying to create a solution. And if you feel like you can't, then you start to feel burned out. And burnout, like I said, is when you're waking up and you don't want to go to work. So if you find yourself day after day waking up and saying, I don't want to go to work, then you are experiencing burnout. If it's just started, then you need to take action. And I will talk about what that action may look like. So there's some things that you can do that can kind of work through that, and then some things that you can practice that can help you be stronger and create resilience. So you want to recognize that. So if you wake up, you don't want to go to work, if you're thinking it's time for a vacation, but you just had one, thinking like probably one of the worst cases, and heard this a few times, but wishing that you could get sick, wishing that you could hurt something so that you can have a reason to be out. Because for whatever reason, it's really hard for firefighters to say, you know, I've had enough, I'm overwhelmed, and I need a break. So when we get hurt or sick and we get to take sick time or have time off, then that somehow is better, because then we have an excuse for it and we don't have to feel guilty or question how strong we are or if we're weak or whatever. So those are signs. Walking around and sighing is another sign. That's a stress sign, but it can also be a sign of burnout. So basically, anything that stresses you out, that constantly activates your stress reaction, is going to contribute to burnout. And then the work-related secondary exposure to trauma, that's part of the job. And that's where our training comes in. So the saying, train like you fight and fight like you train, is meant to help you go do that work and not get caught up in the stress so that you forget what you were doing or how to do it. So you do what you know how to do. You do what you're trained to do. But then when you're done with that, then what do you do? What do you do when you let down and you're not working the call anymore? And so that also is and can be problematic. If you're the type of person that has a view, I can do this, I can do it on my own, I don't need anybody's help, I don't need to talk about it, then that's going to create some problems for you. So the inability or unwillingness to talk and share the experience can create problems, and it makes the traumatic, stressful event have a greater impact. So both of these fall under compassion fatigue. So you could distinguish between them, or you could just call it compassion fatigue and combine it together. It's however however you want to view it. Burnout and secondary traumatic stress tend to have a different feel. So burnout is more being worn out. So like I said, it's usually about, like, you notice it in yourself because you want a break. You need a vacation. You don't want to go to work. You just want to stay in bed. You want a sick day. So burnout is feeling worn out. It's a tired feeling, like you've been overburdened. Now, secondary traumatic stress is, it has a more like anxious feeling. And so how I've read it is they say like being afraid. And I know firefighters don't usually admit that they're afraid. So I think that we tend to experience it more as anxiety. Like we have this anxious energy. And that's having to respond, having to be alert. So it's, you know, we're trained to do a job. We do the job. And sometimes that reaction that we get from going to those traumatic events, or having that traumatic event happen to us, it doesn't go away, and it can linger. And when you have stress after stress after stress, or you experience stressor after stressor, and you have continued reactions, then your system gets activated. So you can have that anxiousness or fear, and then what happens is you start avoiding things. So if you notice that you're avoiding things, whether it's avoiding people or avoiding certain tasks or avoiding certain places, that's a pretty good sign that that also is leading to compassion fatigue. So in the environment, there can still be times where you feel really good about your job. So you can have this compassion satisfaction, but then kind of go back and forth. So there's this interaction. And so the more satisfaction we have, the less negative or compassion fatigue we're going to experience. So there's this interaction going on. So it really is helpful to just keep an eye out and notice the signs as early as possible, and to do something about it. So it's like when you first notice it, it doesn't mean you have to run to a therapist, but it may mean that you have to maybe do a little research, Google compassion fatigue and how to overcome it. You'll find a multitude of things. Building resiliency, you could Google that, and you could find some things that you could build resiliency. It fascinates me, and I still find myself questioning, even though I do know the answer to it. But when people really start to struggle, like when they experience the compassion fatigue, the thing that would help them the most is to interact with people, to take care of themselves, like through exercise, through eating right, minimizing alcohol and drugs. Those are the things that we lose sight of. And it's like when we need to take care of ourselves most, is the time when we let that go. So if you think about what it took for you to get into the fire service, you were working out, you were eating right, probably weren't drinking much. You know, you were taking care of yourself. So you go into the fire service at the top of your game and then slowly start to lose it. And then when you need those things that contributed to you being at your best, you don't do it. So the things that help us the most in those moments are the things we ultimately end up being too tired to do. So we withdraw from it. So as an aside, if you all are interested, there is a self-assessment that you can do online. It's free. It walks you through scoring it, and it can give you some insight on some of the experiences of where you feel satisfaction and where you feel fatigue. And so it's the professional quality of life scale. And if you just go to www.proqual.org, so it's proqol.org, you can take the professional quality of life scale, you can take the test, and then it tells you how to score it. And so it checks in with you, like, are you happy? Are you preoccupied? Do you get satisfaction from being able to help people? Do you feel connected? Do you jump or startle at unexpected sounds? Do you feel invigorated after working with those that you help? Do you find it difficult to separate your personal life from your life as a helper, or you can insert firefighter? I'm not as productive at work because I'm losing sleep over traumatic experiences. I feel trapped by my job. I actually have talked to a lot of people that experience that. And feeling on edge. So I felt on edge about various things. I feel depressed because of my traumatic experiences. And on and on. So there's a number of things that it kind of clue you in, like where you might be experiencing this compassion fatigue. So you can take this test and then review it and identify those areas where you're struggling. And then once you identify those areas, then you can, you could problem solve, you could develop a plan to deal with that area. And if you have several areas of concern, don't let that overwhelm you. And I say that, and I know that if you're going to be overwhelmed, you'll be overwhelmed, but beneficial to work on one thing. Most people have multiple things they want to change and work on. But if you focus on all the things you want to change, then you're not going to be successful in changing those things. So it's like focus on one thing and break it down as small as you can. And in a way, this is really how firefighters work. You know, I was thinking about this because I had a discussion with a couple of my firefighter clients about being in charge. And I remember when I started doing the acting lieutenant job. And I was terrified because I'm like, there's so much I don't know, and I can't solve every problem. And I know that I had gone on several calls, and not every call, but there were quite a few calls where I heard what the problem was, and I thought to myself, I have no idea what to do with that. But instead of being overwhelmed by it, I did a couple things. The first thing I did is to try and break it down into parts, like what are the parts of this problem? And is there a way to deal with the parts that could lend itself to an overall solution? The other thing is I reminded myself that I'm part of a team, and the people I worked with had different expertise than I did. And in most cases, the people that I was working with had the expertise to help resolve the problem that we were going on. So I didn't have to know the solution for everything. It became important to recognize that I didn't have the answer, but I had the capability to break it down, which is one of the things that you can do, is that when you identify areas in which you're struggling, is you break it down. Identify the problem, break it down into the smallest components, and think about what aspects of that can you gain control over. And then if the problem seems too overwhelming, go find help. You bring an expert in. You bring in somebody who can help you with that problem. So the psychological stuff, the psychological process in helping yourself is a lot like what you already do in your job. So identifying what strengths you already have, what works for you, how do you solve problems, and then apply that to whatever might be overwhelming you and creating that fatigue. So when people approach problems this way, they bring everything with them. And this is an important thing because this ties into resiliency as well, because these are things that can create like risk and resiliency in a person, which contributes to why some people burn out sooner than other people. I mean, some people can make it through their whole, 30-year career and leave and be energized and, have a great and full life, while others don't. And a lot of it has to do with our previous experiences. So what you bring into the situation is called your schemas and your beliefs. So it's, you can think of it like it's your story. So what is your story? How do you write your story? And what are your beliefs? And so those are things that like start in infancy, really. So every experience you've had through your life contributes to this, and they build on each other. And sometimes those experiences are not very useful to us. So sometimes we're kind of building current solutions off of old solutions that didn't really work well for us in the first place. Or maybe they worked for us in one environment, but not in the current environment, which is kind of how I view a lot of symptoms when people come in. Like, I hate diagnosing. And a diagnosis is a collection of symptoms that people came together and by consensus and statistics, they decided that it was whatever the label is. And I don't like that, but I look at it as it's a collection of maladaptive strategies that people develop, and this is at that unconscious level, that help them survive in their environment. So then that continues to play out through your life. So somebody that has relationship issues, they may get close to somebody, but then shy away or push them away. So they can either go, this relationship isn't right for me, or they could go, yeah, you're not right for me, and push that person away and hurt that person. And that can come from like an early childhood environment where you couldn't rely on your parents, for instance. So when you had a need, that need wasn't met, or it was met sometimes but not other times. So if there's an inconsistency in that, then it's like you grow up looking at people as, well, these people love me, but they love me. That doesn't mean they're not going to hurt me, and so I'm going to push them away before they hurt me. So that's and that can be a pretty classic sign in a couple different mental health disorders, but it is a way of managing your environment. You learn the best you can to read people, and then when you get nervous, then that's your sense saying this person's going to hurt me, so you push them away. So that's kind of how your schemas and beliefs come out. Or you may believe that you have to be perfect. And so then that means that you're very critical of yourself as an adult and you work hard, You try and control everything you can, but that belief in you that you have to be perfect in order to get that respect or attention, that can make it really hard when you are dealing with anything within the fire service, because you can't know everything and you have to be able to say, I don't know this, and I need help. And so people who believe that they have to know everything, then they're more likely to burn out sooner than later. So then you have your social support system. So, and that can be positive and negative support. And for some of the same reasons I said earlier. And then you have your own personal history of trauma and illnesses. And the traumas, when we talk about the trauma that's required for a diagnosis of PTSD, that's a big T trauma. But we experience little T traumas all the time. So those can be like the little slights that can occur. And in that moment, it hurts us, but we manage it, and we kind of we rationalize it, and then it gets stored away. And then when we look back on it, then we're like, well, that was really no big deal. But those things can come back to haunt us, and it can be quite surprising when it does. And you'll be left, when you see it yourself, you'll be going, I can't believe that bothered me. And then your families and the other people that you're close to, and then, of course, the economic situation. So these are things that you bring with you into the job, and these are the things that can create resilience and risk for us, so that we can be at risk for burnout or compassion fatigue. And these are areas that, if you can recognize them, then you can change some of those things. So we can't change our history, but we can change what we do with it. We can change what it means to us. And this is what brings us into resiliency. So, if you take, just before I move into resiliency really quick, if you take the test at ProQol.org, which I don't belong to at all, so this is a free site, people can use their stuff freely, you're just not supposed to sell it, then you can take the test yourself, and then you can look at those areas where maybe it might be a struggle, and then you can address it and think about these things that I said about, like, what you bring in to the situation. And so what can you change? And I talk a lot about this stuff when I work with clients, because it's hard to get out of our mindset. And so I try and offer a slightly different point of view, and I try and help them open up enough so that they can look at things a little bit different. And sometimes that's all that's really needed. So that's that about compassion fatigue and compassion satisfaction. So we all start out with that satisfaction, and then we can develop that fatigue. And I know that I have experienced burnout many, many times. And I recognize it early enough, and then I go, oh, why am I feeling burned out? What do I need to do for myself? So, but it comes up for everybody. So, Now, let's think about resilience. So we bring stuff with us that carries risk and resilience. So I guess the first thing is, what is resilience? And I would ask people this when I saw them in session. So, what is resilience to them? People can have slightly different definitions, and the definitions may be incomplete, or sometimes they could be inaccurate. And so then we discuss really what it is, and how do we complete it, or how might we shift it a little bit so it is more true and useful. So I think most people would say that resilience is the ability to bounce back from something difficult that we experience. And I used to think that it was that you bounced back well, but it doesn't necessarily mean that. It means that you bounce back. Whether it's bouncing back in a good way or bad way. I don't know what a bad way is. I think about like growth. You bounce back, but it is an opportunity for growth. So it really is more than that. I've talked about resilience in the past, and I've mentioned it in some of my presentations. So for me, resiliency is not just bouncing back, but it is, it's bouncing back and growing. And so, and I can't remember where I had read this, but I did, in some reading I did, I came across a description that just really resonated, and it was resiliency, encompasses three components. So one is flexibility, and then learning, and then adaptability. And I really like that one because I think that that applies really well to the fire service. The calls that we go on are varied. I mean, except for maybe like the frequent flyers, you're always facing something different. Sometimes drastically different, sometimes slightly different, but it's different. And so there has to be a flexibility. So I said that one of the ways that we can combat the secondary traumatic stress piece is by using our training, use our training to do the job, and then come back and talk about it. So we don't always see exactly what we train for. So we have to be flexible. Maybe we're faced with something and we try a solution and it doesn't quite work. So then we have to be flexible enough to try something else. And then we learn from it. So that all gets filed away. So every experience we have gets filed away, whether we consciously commit it to memory or not. Our brain is constantly taking in information and storing it. And so when we face situations, it's like our brain is like going through all our experiences and looking for similar experiences to tell us how we should be in this instance. And when it doesn't find an exact match, it will find the closest match and then go, oh, we tried this, so let's do this. And then we get feedback from that. So every time I use that analogy, I think of a little person in my brain going through the Rolodex. So that's that learning piece. So we have to be flexible because not everything is something we faced before. And then we have to learn, and then we adapt. So it's not enough to be flexible and learn from the situation if we can't apply it next time. So that ability to apply it next time means that we are adapt. That really fits with the fire service. It certainly resonated with me. So if we think about resiliency in that way, that also provides kind of a, like maybe a framework of how we can increase our resiliency. So, if you think about it, if we think about flexibility, it's like, well, how can you be more flexible in a situation? I know people that are very rigid in their schedule, for instance. So they have to do things in a certain way at a certain time. And I'm not talking about like OCD rigid. There are a lot of people who are very high functioning and I would consider healthy people who have a certain rigidity. And so if things don't go according to how they planned it, or if it doesn't happen when they plan it, then they get upset. And then they could be a little cranky for a while. You know, and if you deal with a kid who somehow has become rigid, then they can just full on melt down, which is never good. Although I have seen adults melt down too when they couldn't do things the way that they had laid them out. So that could be somebody who just like schedules everything and does everything according to schedule. So a person like that would be driven crazy by somebody like me, because I am kind of a fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants person. And if you heard my discussion last time, it might make sense why, because I'm one of those people that have ADHD. I learned how to function. One of my primary methods of functioning was to procrastinate. And procrastination provided enough anxiety for me that I could stay focused and get things done. And honestly, I didn't like it, but that's what I did. That was my primary mode of operation. So then people thought, well, she doesn't care, or she's disorganized and doesn't plan, which actually that's kind of true. You know, it's one of those things that is, it's like a constant project for me. And that's why the fire service actually ended up being so good, because of the structure that it offered. Having that plan and following it can get in the way. It can get in the way of resilience. So you have to create some flexibility, and maybe not like my flexibility, because that causes problems too, but something in the middle. So being able to kind of take things as they come and not see that as a failure or a plan gone wrong. So flexibility, it's important. So if you recognize in yourself areas where you're flexible, but in others you're not, then which area causes you the most problems? Which one creates the most stress for you? This is all coming back to how do you deal with the stressors you are exposed to? So think about your flexibility in thinking, flexibility in behaving, flexibility in all aspects. So it's not necessarily physical flexibility, although physical flexibility is helpful in your physical health. So you could also address that too. And then the next thing is that learning. So do you learn? There was a really amazing TED Talk. And it was a psychologist who studied human behavior, and it was on stress. And so our way of thinking about stress has been rooted in the negative, like stress hurts us. Stress causes damage. Stress wears us down. Stress will cause us to break down. And if you think about like where, when we first started thinking about stress, like Hans Selye, his model, that was based on experimenting and observing rats. Well, the rats were put in a highly stressful situation just by virtue of being experimented on. So of course, the origin of our idea of stress would say that stress is negative. But this TED Talk, she talked about how much stress impacts you depends on how you view stress. And that's kind of where this learning piece comes in. So if you view stress as an opportunity to learn, then stress will have less of an impact on you. And so this TED Talk really excited me, and I started reading more and more and watching more TED Talks about her and then some of her colleagues. And I thought, well, this is really exciting. And this applies to the fire service also. And this also applies to resiliency, because resiliency also comes down to how you view stressful things. How do you view bad things? How do you grow from that? Do you internalize when things go wrong as being like a function of you being defective somehow? Do you allow yourself to make mistakes? I work with people, general public and firefighters, that they can forgive other people's mistakes. They can look at other people and say, yeah, it's human nature to make a mistake. But when it comes to themselves, they realize that they don't allow that same thought process for themselves. It's like somehow they've developed this idea that they have to be perfect, or by not accomplishing whatever they set out to, then they failed. And when you are looking at things as being a failure, then you're creating more stress for yourself, and you're failing from learning. Oh, I said failed. So sometimes the way around that is not to say fail. It's like, well, I didn't learn this time, but next time I will. So just a subtle shift in how we view what we are dealing with can open up a wide gap for learning. So learning is very important. And again, that goes back to, you know, what people bring into the situation, that that schema, belief system, and just the ability, the way they cognitively process what happens. So learning is very important. So it also increases your confidence and your sense of your sense of confidence. It can be a strength, and it can highlight your abilities better. So these are factors in resiliency. Some of them, there's like a lot of factors, but some of them is that capacity to make realistic plans and take steps to carry them out. So that's the flexibility in the moment, but also the learning, and then being able to adapt, so carry it forward to new and novel situations. A positive view of yourself and confidence in your strength and abilities. So knowing that you can experience something that is stressful, and while it might be unpleasant, you can still have the flexibility to manage it in the moment, and then reflect on it and learn how you could do it better, or how you could avoid that particular issue. So then that would give you a greater sense of confidence and strength. So, and then the skills in communication and problem solving. So sometimes learning means that you have to bring somebody else in. So like I said, when I was an acting lieutenant, I realized that I didn't have to have all the answers, but it did mean that I had to ask for help. I had to ask for input. And so being able to communicate that and work on problem solving. So sometimes my crew didn't have the answer either, but together we are able to figure it out. So sometimes it takes more than just you. But that's another way to learn and to bring that in. So when you can take a stressful situation and you can be flexible in that moment and you can learn from it and know that you can learn from it, then your attitude has just shifted, your belief about what stress is and what it does to you has shifted. So it means that you have some sense of mastery. And so you are likely to have a more positive outcome, and you are more likely to be a person that can get through your career without being devastated. And that does not mean that people who don't do it are weak. It means that you have a different life story. You have different experiences. You have a different temperament. I mean, there's so much that goes into that. And so people handle their stress differently. They react differently. And then they make sense out of it differently. And you can only operate within what you know. And when you are operating within what you know is not, and it's a little shaky or it has some flaws in it because of what your experiences have been, then it puts you on shaky ground. And so then you may be learning something that is not all that useful for you. So again, being able to ask for help. And so asking for help is a big factor in building resilience and being able to communicate that. So then another factor is the capacity to manage strong feelings and impulses. So learning is a cognitive process. It's a logical process. Now, I don't want to say you need to ignore your emotions, but solutions that come solely out of emotions are not going to be the best solutions. They're not going to be the firmest solution. It's not going to give you the firmest foundation for future. So it doesn't really lend itself to adaptability. But logic also can be flawed as well. Because our emotions can affect how we think about things, what we say about things, what we say to ourselves. So, it's more appropriate to find that middle ground, find where they overlap. Therapy modality, dialectical behavioral therapy, they talk about wise mind. So that's that overlap of emotional mind and our logical mind or reasonable mind. So that overlap is wise mind. So you take the information that comes in. So so essentially you're managing your strong feelings and then you're not acting impulsively. So that's more conducive to learning. So wise mind is what you want to strive for because there's information in our thoughts, there's information in the emotions that we're experiencing, and there's information in our body sensations. So if you can if you listen to each one of those and you can kind of bring it together, then you're going to be in a place where you're going to get the best information out of it. So you will have optimal learning. So that also will lend itself to better foundation to build the future experiences on. So flexibility, learning, and adaptability. Those are really important factors for or components of resilience. And it helps you to build some of the other resilience factors and strategies. So obviously learning from your past is a kind of a big theme here. So you have to know when what you bring with you from your past, like when your story gets in the way. And everybody has a story that they hold onto about themselves that was created long before they could even talk. It started back in infancy, and then we create that story over time. And sometimes that story is faulty and it gets in the way and it becomes a stuck point. So that's one of those things that can lead to a mental health problem developing. It also gets in the way of being resilient, and it can contribute to it could be a risk factor. So it can contribute to that compassion fatigue. So learn from your past. Try and step outside. Look at it and try and shift one step over and look at it again, or put on different glasses and view it again. So anything that you can do to help you shift your perspective a little bit will help you see how your story may be contributing to you being stuck, and then allow you to learn from the past. So the past is the past, but you can still choose what you want to do with it. So how can you shift your thinking about it to contribute to being more resilient, so that you can better manage the stress that, or the stressors that you experience today? So this is kind of an ongoing process. So it continually takes place. But there are some practical things that you can do. There are a multitude of things that you can do to build resilience. So you've probably heard and read, but social connection is the number one coping strategy, social support. So the support of your officer, the support of your coworkers, the support of your family, the support of friends. So being connected to people. So if you notice that you are trying to avoid people, then that is a big sign that you're going down the wrong road. Now, last time I spoke, I shared with people about the invisible disabilities, because I have ADHD. I took a medication that ended up being too high of a dose, and that was when I was presenting at FDIC. And so I got fixated, mentally fixated on a problem, and I couldn't let go of it, and it ruined my presentation, and it devastated me. And I was pretty devastated for a couple weeks. One of the things that I noticed, looking back on it, and it was pretty obvious to me, but I was walking around. I did not want to interact with anybody. I did not want to connect with anybody. I was there with my husband, because he teaches too, and I didn't even really want to talk to him, but I knew I needed to talk about it, because keeping it living in your mind and trying to deal with it yourself is not a way to reach a solution. And I really needed support. And so I fought the urge to hide from everybody. So I did interact with some really good friends that I see every year at FDIC, and I'm so very thankful for them and for my husband. So that connection is crucial. And so if you find yourself wanting to avoid people, that's a sign that you are in trouble. And so building resilience means that you need to go towards people. You need to make connections. So even if you have the urge to run away from them, go make the connection. Avoid seeing the crisis as insurmountable. I know that's easier said than done. And that kind of goes back to that TED Talk I mentioned that was just so amazing, is that when the people that are most resilient and deal with stress the best are the people who experience a stressful situation, and they have a stress reaction. So it doesn't mean that you don't react, mean that you don't experience that unpleasantness, but they have their reaction, and then they're like, oh, I can do something about this. And so being able to come around to, I can do something about this, is really powerful. In fact, that contributes to, well, I'm going to say a couple other things, and then I'll say the thought I was just going to say. So problems are not insurmountable. They're problems, and you can figure them out, and you will. And you're a firefighter, and you deal with problems all the time, and there's a way to deal with them. It's just that when we start to get into trouble, we forget that we can deal with the problem. So as a whole, in general, firefighters are actually pretty resilient, but there's so much that can go on and pile on that sometimes we forget these things. And so this is a reminder. So, it's like, take a step back, look at the problem. And even if you can't figure out how to resolve it and you want to say it's never going to be solvable, it's never going to get better, I'm never going to get over this, you need to shift your thinking just a little bit about it and say, this is a big problem. And I'm going to have to work on it. Even just saying that, I mean, it doesn't say you're going to solve it, but it certainly doesn't imply it's unsolvable or insurmountable. So just a subtle shift in how you describe it can open room. It can open a crack of possibility and hope in there. And that can go a long way. Accept that change is part of living. I hate change. You could ask my husband. I hate change. But I know it's inevitable, and so I force myself through it. But it's not always pretty, and I know that. But I know that change is going to happen, and I know that I have to change, and I've changed a lot. And none of it has ever been, oh, I won't say never, but I definitely didn't like any of it. So even if it was something like moving from an old small house into a really big, beautiful house, I still didn't like it because it meant change. Move towards your goals. So having some goals. So when people get overwhelmed by various stressors, then they start to lose sight of their goals. So remind yourself that there are still things to accomplish. And then accomplish one thing. One thing, that's all you have to do. I know people that make lists of things that they need to accomplish. I've started making lists. But I also know that when your list gets pretty big, it can become overwhelming. So what I do and what I tell my clients is look at your list and pick one thing. Just pick one thing. Put it on a post-it note and put that somewhere else where you can see it, and it's that one thing that you accomplish. And accomplishing one thing can feel really good. And then you get to take it off your list, and so you're not looking at everything you have to do. You're just looking at one thing. So in those times when you're feeling overwhelmed, you're feeling overstressed, you're feeling burned out, then pick one thing to accomplish, one thing that feels good to you moving in the direction you want to go. Take decisive action. So that kind of goes hand in hand with moving towards your goal. It's like picking one thing and doing it. Be mindful about it. And not detaching. So if you have a problem that you're struggling with, then look at it head on and take a step towards resolving it. Be decisive about it. Be purposeful about it. I know that sometimes I have problems and I just think, well, if I don't look at it, it'll go away. And that's not true. A lot of times that just makes the situation worse and bigger. So nurture a positive view of yourself. So everything that you do and accomplish, no matter how big or how small, recognize it. Pat yourself on the back for it. That helps to build resilience. That helps you to feel more confident and feel like you have more confidence. When we're struggling with a variety of stressors, and those stressors overwhelm us, and if we're in that place where we have developed depression, anxiety, or even PTSD, then it becomes more and more important to find something positive to be able to say about ourselves. A lot of times in therapy, we're focused on changing something that you don't like about yourself. And so there tends to be a focus on the thing that you want to change, which of course is something that is negative about yourself. So it's good to shift that and start picking out some positives and nurture that every day. One little thing every day, it goes a long way. Keeping things in perspective. So I think that kind of goes along with, like seeing that it's, that the crisis is not insurmountable and that it's part of living. It's perspective. So I think I've talked long enough that my hands-free might have gone dead. Okay, I'm still on. And I'm wrapping up. I know that this has been long tonight, so I'm almost done. So I think I might have talked longer than my hands free, so it looks like it's still good. So perspective is important. So and this, sometimes people get perspective because they can compare themselves to like bigger problems, but sometimes that backfires. So comparing yourself and your situation to other people is not always a good strategy in this case. It works sometimes, but it backfires in other times. So that's probably not the best way to do it. But I think it's like looking at the event as, not being the worst. Not being something that's going to like haunt you the rest of your life. I know that after my presentation at FDIC, I'm like, I'm never presenting again. And because I thought, that's it, I'm done. it was horrible. It was unprofessional. And I'm never going to present again. So that was kind of blowing it out of proportion. So I definitely lost perspective. But I did get over it. So it just took a little time and I needed to get off the medication. Maintain a hopeful outlook. And so sometimes that's harder than other times. So that's looking, giving those little cracks. It doesn't have to be something wide open. You don't have to have like wide open arms for it. It's create a crack. And if you find that you can't find hopefulness, that you can't find that things can change, then that's a good time to go find a mental health professional or a pastor or somebody who can hold hope for you. I've had so many people come in who had their story was hopeless. They expressed hopelessness. They believed that nothing was ever going to change. And I was able to provide them with a little bit of hope. So it's like I could hold the hope for them. And that's part of what I do. So I can hold the pain, but I can also hold the hope when they can't seem to fit it in themselves. And then we just make a crack. Taking care of yourself, that is when people are overwhelmed, they stop taking care of themselves. And sometimes people find that that's all they can do. I had a woman client who was deeply depressed and anxious, and she could barely function, but she would get up, take a shower, dry her hair, put makeup on, and dress. And that made her feel a little bit better. And it was pretty much the least that she can do. But I know people that don't shower for weeks because it's just too much. But if you can take care of yourself, like take care of your hygiene, and then try and expand that out, find activities that you enjoy and you find relaxing, the things that you no longer, if you find that you don't enjoy certain things, that you don't find things pleasurable anymore, which is a sign of depression, then pick one thing that uses the least amount of energy and do it, or do some aspect of it. And if you can't, then maybe connect with someone that can be an energy buddy. So when you can't do things yourself, sometimes being in the vicinity of somebody else that has energy, and not too much, because there's nothing worse than being around somebody with a lot of energy when you have none. But find somebody who can kind of just be there with you, and they can be your energy buddy, and then they can help you just by virtue of being there, do some things for yourself. So take care of yourself. So pay attention to eating. If you lose your appetite, then eat by a schedule and eat healthy things. Eat small, healthy meals. And try and exercise. And if exercising to you is running and lifting weights and you can't get yourself to do it, try and rethink what exercise is. You just need to move your body. So get out and walk, and try and walk in the sun. Walk outside. Go walk in nature, because nature is healing. And then meditation and spiritual practice. Those are other things too. So go back to the church. If you are religious and you used to go to church regularly, go back to the church. Start meditating. And I can't explain now like about meditation, but there are so many different ways that you can meditate, and you can do any type of meditation where you focus on something. So you could focus on breath. You can focus on your five senses. So there's a lot of ways that you can do it. So you can Google it and find something that resonates with you. It's very helpful. So those are some things that you can do to help you build resilience that will help you be able to be flexible, to learn from the incident, the event, to learn from your past and be able to change it and use it, and then to incorporate it for future. So you're trying to build a strong, solid foundation, and then keep doing it, and don't stop. It's kind of a lifelong process, and as you work through all this, it will become you, and it will become your process. And you might need help. It really depends on where you're at with what you're experiencing. So reach out. And that was the thing I was going to say is so often I have people that call me and I can hear in their voice how done they are, how overwhelmed they are. And they come in and we chat and they connect, then almost always they'll say, you know, just making the call and coming here made me feel better. And so taking that one little step towards a positive change, that is that crack of hope. And it's one small step that can start you on the healing, your path to building resilience, your path to being healthy. So I think that that's probably enough. I talked a little longer than I had expected, but I think I covered everything I wanted to. So there's been a lot going on in my life. And so, as always, my presentations are connected to what my experience is. But these are also things that I've been hearing from my clients, and particularly my firefighter clients, and also what I've gotten questions on. So I hope that this helps you. So anybody that was listening, I hope it was helpful. I hope it was not too rambly. I did actually work off an outline, and I was just trying to like fill in the blanks with all the stuff that I've learned and what I've experienced with my clients. So I hope that you find it helpful as well. So again, I want to thank Fire Engineering and Penwell in allowing me to have this opportunity to share this information with you. So please feel free to contact me if you have questions or you want to talk, you need direction to find somebody to talk to you. I am happy to walk people through the process of finding their own help. I'm in Washington State, but people walk through the process of finding their own support in their state, in their city. So please contact me if you want to, or if there's something else you want to hear, then let me know. So again, my phone number that you can reach me at is 425-281-7977. And my email is blmurphy63@mac.com. So I hope this was helpful to you. There's so much more that I could say about these things, but you know, I'm just trying to get you some information so that you can get started on your own journey. So thank you very much for listening. Contact me with questions, and thank you for your time and attention, and have a great night or day whenever you happen to listen to this.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.